From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. This is Paul Edwards, and I am in Miami, Florida, and I'd like to welcome everyone to Tuesday Topics this evening. I'd like to, as usual, express my appreciation to Brian Charlson, our co-producer, and to Steve Bauer, our recorder and editor. And, of course, I want to thank George Byes from Talking Communities, without whose software we would not be doing this show. Tonight, we're going to be talking about a big word, but a word that's actually become pretty significant for people who are blind over the last 10 or 15 years, and that word is entrepreneurship. There are an awful lot of people who are blind now who are seriously thinking about starting their own business. And I wanted us to take the opportunity of talking with someone who actually is in business for himself about how he ended up getting there, what he does. And I've had the opportunity of talking with our guest a number of times in the past, and he has an immense amount of information and a large store of good ideas on the subject of entrepreneurship. And so it is a great pleasure for me to welcome to our microphone this evening Mr. William Benjamin. So, William, why don't you begin, if you would, by telling us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about the business that you're in.
Well, thank you, Paul. I appreciate it. And it's quite humbling that you invite me to be on your show, and I didn't realize how surprised I'd be when you called and invited me to join. My name is William Benjamin, and I guess you could say I'm a piano tuner, and I will go into a lot more about that later, being satisfied with who you are, but I'll just run through this real quick, and many of you will understand that I've been in Toastmasters. I recognize the difference between formal speeches, recited speeches, written speeches, and things like that. This evening, I have brought no notes. I'm here to visit and just share and let a little bit of the emotion gush into it all. I was born back in 58 in Minnesota, and after a couple of years at the Minnesota State School for the Blind, my parents realized that they didn't want me to be so far away from them in the School for the Blind, so they moved to California to get me a better education. I have retinitis pigmentosa, and at fourth grade, I quit being able to read even the largest of print, and yes, I was one of those partials that the teacher in class shouted at me and said, if you would just practice, you could read. And of course, it wasn't true. And so from fourth grade through ninth grade, all of my education was memorization. And then my parents moved up to Northern California, to the Bay Area from Los Angeles. And I attended the Berkeley School for the Blind for 1 year while virtually my center of attention was to learn Braille. I'd already graduated from the ninth grade, and they agreed to let me go through the ninth grade a second time because that's all the further the school in Berkeley went, and so they kind of cheated and got me in there, and I was able to take lots of music classes and any fun classes I wanted as long as I took at least two Braille classes every day and got some of my Braille fundamentals. And after that, went to Oakland High School and did miserably. After that, I graduated and went to Los Angeles Valley Junior College, majoring in music. And in the second year, I left just before they kicked me out because I had no skills, and I didn't even know it at the time. After that, I went back to my State Department of Rehabilitation worker, George Fogarty, a wonderful man. He gave me a vocational interest test. Virtually what he said is, you like math and music and business and meeting the public, and you'll make a great piano tuner, sign here and be ready to leave in the morning. And so I did. I went to the Emil Fries School of Piano Tuning, and was empowered. I actually had something I could do that I liked and enjoyed and I could excel in. I moved to, after graduation, to Eureka, California, where I bought books on philosophy and read my brains out in Braille, Young and Salinger and Thoreau, and went back to school, scheduled my appointments around my school schedule, and immediately went from D's and F's to A's and B's. And I sat in the front row and forced myself to use a slate and stylus. And so at this point, I was empowered enough where I opened a store and then moved to Redding, California, and opened a second store, and then had a business in Ukiah, California, and basically had three businesses in three towns. And it was a little too long to go into right now, but anyhow, with some wonderful arrangements, a young man that was working on his pilot's license and trying to get enough hours to get his multi-engine instrument instructors said that if I rented the plane, he would fly me for free in whatever town we landed in. He would study in his books, and he went to school Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and I tuned on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and so I had a private pilot flying me around and was able to do things a lot of tuners don't do, including tuning for people who were in the recording business back then. I worked for Johnny Cash and the Pointer Sisters and Pablo Cruz, and I tuned Merle Haggard's personal pianos for 10 years, and so I was quite active and enjoyed it a lot. And after that, I wanted to see if I could really go to the city and compete, so I moved to Oakland, California, and went to school for Sherman. I went to work for Sherman Clay. They're the largest store in the world, and started at their flagship warehouse at the bottom and worked myself to the top, preparing new Steinways out of the box. After doing that for 3 or 4 years, I got invited back to the piano hospital to teach the business classes, along with tuning and rebuilding. So I went back, and from 97 to 2003, I taught business classes and helped students write business plans and taught tuning and rebuilding. And then I went to the 98 Orlando National Convention, and I met a perfectly bubbly young lady from Tallahassee, Florida, and fell in love. And even though I had just built my dream home, I got rid of everything and quit my job and moved to Florida and married her, and here I am. And I'm very lucky. Right now I can just play with my career. I tune and rebuild. I had a little store. I wrote a grant and opened a store when I got here. But after the 4 years, Sally happened to have a stroke, and it so happened that when I would go out tuning, she would watch the store. But after the stroke, I banished her from the shop, and the shop started showing the problems of it, because every time I'd go out, then I didn't have anyone to watch the shop. So I've closed the store, and I'm selling pianos out of the house and doing tuning, but I'm very much relaxed. We have 4 acres here to take care of, and I just love it. And I'm 60 years old now, so it's time for me to start enjoying planting flowers in a garden and things like that, and not work as hard as I used to. But I guess the thing I want to put across is those few elements of this opening dissertation, that yes, you can do it if you force yourself to work with that Braille, and also that there's more to it than some of these simple titles, like I'm a piano tuner. You can take it as far as you want to go. I have a number of friends who have very successful businesses in stores and piano tuning both. And so it just depends on how far you want to take it and how entrepreneurish you want to be. That's the key. I have a lot of people who have turned their nose up at piano tuning or looked down on piano tuning. And I don't care what it is, Mary Kay or Avon or any one of a number of things. If you want to take it to another level, you can certainly do it. And that's the message I'm bringing tonight.
That's excellent. So, William, help us perhaps to understand what you would perceive the meaning of the word entrepreneur to be. And maybe tell us a little bit about what some of the characteristics a good entrepreneur has to have.
I've never looked up the definition, but from what I've conceived, entrepreneur means willing to endeavor in new and exciting things and take them to their limit. Maybe that would be a good project, is to look up that word entrepreneur. But someone who wants to sail uncharted territory and develop success above and beyond the norm. That's what it is. One of the things that helped guide me is when I was at the Piano Hospital, State Department of Rehabilitation today doesn't give grants to anybody unless they have a business plan. And so it was my project to figure out what a business plan was and all that stuff. And I had a business plan done once for me before by Humboldt State University, and I didn't really conceive it. But when I was at the Piano Hospital, I had students from many different states, and so I wrote letters to many different states and even some phone calls and found out their guidelines for all these different states of what a good business plan is. And then I took them and laid them all out on the desk and said, now which lines are on all of these, you know, that they should have where your business has been, where your business is now, a sheet page on where your business is going, a page on assets you bring to the table, a page of needs that you bring to the table. Basically, a business plan is a group of pages that tells the story of your business and the needs of where your business is going. And also at the Piano Hospital, one of the things I learned is I oftentimes wake up in the middle of the night and couldn't sleep, and I got to my computer and I said, now how can I put this to work for me? And I did. I put it to work and developed a dissertation called Metamorphoses. And what it is a book on how to be successful or start a business in spare time. And that's also, you know, for those of you that have a job and you're working for someone, I would say to you, don't quit your job and run out and start a business with what they call 3 months of working capital, because it's going to go away in 2.5 months. But if you stay with the company you're with and wake up in the middle of the night and work on your company, there just might come a time when you're drug away from your steady job kicking and screaming. That's the way to go into business, when it pulls you into it and demands that you pay attention, because there's a lot of money that can be made, not when you wish you could make some money and go looking for it. It's one of those myths that I bring up in Metamorphoses, like, when do you get a loan? You don't get a loan when you're broke, because you can't pay a loan back. You get a loan when you're successful and you have the plenty of money to be able to make those payments right now the way you are, and you borrow the money to invest in a parallel project that can make you big money. But you can make those payments if that big money doesn't come. You don't make the loan because you need money, because you can never pay it back. So entrepreneurship, I think what it is to me is being able to go on to that uncharted waters and find untold success.
So essentially, though, you've chosen, at least through a fair amount of your life, not to just be a piano tuner who kind of have sat back and waited for calls to come in saying, oh, I got a piano for you to tune, son. Instead, you actually at one point ran 3 stores and then went back to teach. And even in Tallahassee, you opened a store where you sold pianos as well as tuned them. And I guess In addition, as I recall it, you actually sell other things that relate to pianos as well. Is that a part of being an entrepreneur as well? That is, being able to put together not just a single task like tuning pianos, but a more complex business where you're actually doing a number of different things at once?
I think so. It's packaging yourself, and it's marketing yourself. I market myself. There's just no doubt about it. And nice of you to mention that, Paul. Yes, when I had the piano boutique open as a brick-and-mortar store, one of the things we wanted to do is have fun in the business. And so we ordered crystal instruments, crystal pianos and crystal violins and crystal saxophones. We had coffee cups that were wonderful, like that the sayings on them, like musicians duet better, or tune it or die was one of the sayings, or old musicians never die, they just go from bar to bar. And I love music, and it was a little heart, I heart music with a cupid arrow through the heart. And it was for fun. There wasn't a lot of big money in it, but it certainly was enjoyable, and it kept the excitement of the store. It kept us alive and enjoying the little business. And also, I went to the national convention and had a table where we brought all those products, and it was lots of fun meeting people, and we did that for 2 or 3 years. And this year we're not going to do it. Sally and I are just going to play at this convention, and so there will not be a piano boutique at the exhibit hall this year. But it's marketing yourself, and I used to really try to impress on my students about marketing oneself. If somebody calls me who has no idea who I am from the phone book, I run phone book ads and newspaper ads, and somebody calls me from the phone book or the newspaper with no other thing in the world guiding them, and I pick up the phone and say, "The Piano Boutique, may I help you?" The only thing they have to go on is my voice. They have not heard my tuning. They don't know who I know. They don't know my credentials, which is the highest you can get in America today. They know nothing about me except the lilt in my voice and my eagerness to help and the diction and the clarity of one's voice. And the vocabulary that I choose. They have nothing to go on but that conversation. And so if they hang up at the phone and don't have a piano tuning, they say, "Oh, I just called for prices," then I lost a sale. And if I find the right words and the smooth delivery and market myself properly, then they'll say, "Well, let's make an appointment. When are you available?" So it comes down to marketing oneself. There's no doubt about it. And you have to market yourself every day of the year.
Do you think that blind people have more difficulty marketing themselves than people who aren't blind? For instance, when you were at the animal hospital, did you find that that there were a lot of blind folks who probably needed to work on that as a pretty major skill?
Well, there's a couple things I want to comment on right off. Number one, I appreciate you saying, "Do you think?" Because everybody, these are my opinions. This is not the almighty truth and wisdom of life. These are just my little feelings, and I'm sharing with you, and I don't want you to think I have the market on rightness. But these are just my opinions. But also, you made Sally and I giggle there, Paul, when you said the animal hospital. That's wonderful. But I think it doesn't make a hoot of difference. People are people. There's going to be 10% perfectly successful and 10% perfectly failures and 80% in the middle of most everything. I suppose there could be a skew in the disability forum, but I would like to think, throw the blindness out. Get rid of it, shake it off, and it's there. There's no doubt about it. I sometimes mention my blindness on the phone if it comes up for one reason or another, or I make a point when I'm going to refer to my driver. Sometimes it does not come up. Most of the time I show up at the door and the people have no idea that I'm going to be blind. I do remember specifically here a couple of years ago, I showed up at the door, a Hispanic lady, and I'm not typecasting at all here or what is it, profiling at all, but when she opened the door, I could feel the thickness of the air that she was immediately skeptical that I was blind. And I want to tell you, by the end of that appointment, I won her over, and she's still a good customer today. And it happens. It just happens, and you have to put your best foot forward. One of the things I say in Metamorphoses, in fact, it's the only thing I say twice, is that you never get a second chance to make a first impression. And that's just so important, I'll say it again. You never get a second chance to make a first impression.
Excellent. I'm going to open it up in just a minute so that other people who may have some questions or comments, William. But I would be remiss if I didn't ask if folks would like to get hold of your book, Metamorphoses, how can they do that?
Well, for a while, I was printing it in print and binding it, cone binding it, and I actually had a couple people order it in Braille, and I was charging like $30, $40 for it, you know, because Braille is so expensive to produce one book at a time, and actually Robert did it for me, and it never did sell. It was no great success. It was a fun project, and that's why I refer to it as a dissertation, and if somebody wanted a copy of it, I think I'd just put it on disk and send it to you. I have no great expectations of being a multimillionaire anymore selling a book. I guess I'm not the world's greatest author, or I don't know how to market it or something like that. But if somebody wanted it, let me know. I'm on the FCB listserv. You can get a hold of me that way, or it's blindwilly@comcast.net. If you want my formal address, it's pianoboutique@comcast.net, and I'll just send you a disc.
That's excellent. One last question, I think. You spent a lot of time working on the development of what amounted to, or perhaps the perfect composite state plan. Could you spend just a couple of minutes and tell us what you think most VR agencies want to see in a state business plan?
Well, that's a good one. To begin with, in Metamorphoses, there's a chapter that talks about how to write a business plan. And the book is for general purposes, and it's, you know, it's really hard to give instructions how to do something to everybody across the board, because they all have their own individual businesses and their own individual interests and their own flavor to their business, and you just can't cover everything all at the same time. But the things that I think are important is marketing it. Number one, you want a cover page with the name of the business and the date of when you're doing it, and your name on the cover page. And what I would do is cone bind mine. Use a cone binder, and if you don't have one, you go down to Office Depot and they'll do it for you. And they'll even run copies of it for you if you want three or four copies for different reasons. But I put a plastic sheet on the front and back, so it's pretty. And when you open it up, the first thing that I think is important is an introduction letter, and I do that as a letter. And then from there on out, the important thing is on each page that they all have the same heading, name, address, and phone number, and on the left top side is how I do it. And then when you get down to about the sixth or eighth line, in the center of the page, the title of what that page is. I write the pages in what they call classic English form. And to go through that real briefly, let's say you have five paragraphs, and each paragraph, let's say, has three sentences. And the first paragraph is going to be the introduction paragraph. And that introduction paragraph, the first sentence is going to be introducing the introduction page. And the second one's going to mention the three topics you want to talk about in that page. And the third sentence of that first paragraph is going to conclude what the page is about. Well, the next three paragraphs are going to be the three things you mentioned in the second sentence of the first paragraph. And then the bottom paragraph is going to be, the first sentence is going to be saying that you've talked about everything in your page, and the center sentence is going to be name the three things that you talked about, and the third sentence of the fifth paragraph at the end of the page is going to say goodbye to everybody on that subject. That's classic English form. And I follow that classic English form with, you know, some variations. Sometimes I have four paragraphs, sometimes I have six. Some paragraphs wind up with two sentences, but you know what I'm talking about here. It's the layout. Every single page is just as consistent as can be. That's what they want to see. They all have the same headings. They all have the paragraphs with a blank line in between in what we call block form. The first page I do, what do they call it? I forget the name of their, anyhow, your educational background and all of that stuff. Resume. Oh, there's a word to remember. The first page is a resume. And if your resume, you know, some people say a resume should be only one page, and other people say I can't possibly put the things I've accomplished in life on one page. I understand that, and there's more than one way to do it, so whatever it takes. If you're going to do one page of resume, do it. If you're going to do three, do it. But resume goes first. The next page is history of the business. The next page is how do I see my business today, and where you are, and what you're doing, and how you're getting by with what you have. Next page is going to be where you want to go with your business. The next page you could say is what it would take to get you to where you want to go. Every business plan has to have a page of the resources you bring to the table. Every resume has to have a page on what you need to accomplish your goals. In other words, the money you're asking for or the equipment you're asking for. Every business plan loves to see a page on what makes your business unique and special. As much as we might think that that's silliness, people like that. It brings it down to earth. Every business plan should have a spreadsheet of growth in your business over the last few years, 3 to 5 years. Even if it was college education over the 3 or 5 years, what you did and what you studied, and this is different than a resume. This is talking about how you enjoyed it and why you applied it to your field. Every business plan should have a list of items that they need and what they cost, and what the money you'll be going for, and things like that. It should be a financial report. That's not a bad thing to have. Mine wound up being 23 pages. It's not that unreasonable. If you can't do a 23-page report, you can't run a business. We're not talking about thousands of pages like the government does. We're not talking about hundreds of pages like the state does. 26 pages. 24 pages, 26 pages. If you can't organize that much thinking, you shouldn't be running a business.
I keep saying it's my last question. The state of Florida requires not only a business plan, but they also require you to at least raise a portion of the funds that you need. When I'm talking about the state of Florida, I'm talking about the Division of Blind Services, because I'm assuming here that at least a large portion of our audience are folks who are blind or visually impaired. What they say is that in addition to writing a business plan, you actually have to arrange to borrow some money from somewhere else, whether it's the Small Business Administration, whether it's a bank loan or whatever. Do you think that's a reasonable expectation for a state to have?
Well, if that's true now, they've changed it in the last few years, because it wasn't true when I came here and set up the Piano Boutique and contacted, because when I went to work for the Piano Hospital, I pretty much set my whole business aside and got rid of the businesses and all that stuff, and the piano hospital provided me with computers and scanners and all that stuff. And so when I left the piano hospital, I had nothing and sure didn't want to pay for everything myself. So I went to state rehab, and they did. They said, all right, you're starting over, so we'll help you out a reasonable amount. And they did. And I did not have to borrow money. And I think if you did a page on an argument of why you can't borrow money, let's say you don't have the credit, then make an argument for it. Here's one little tidbit of information I'm going to throw out to everybody. Be prepared to get a flat no. It's almost protocol that when people ask for something, they say no. And at the drop of a hat, say, I appeal, and appeal everything. You can always appeal and fight it, and you can force them to change their mind. In my experience, every time I've asked for something, they've said no, and I stand back my heels and say, no, I won't accept that. We're going to go through this again, and I need to explain it a little better because I'm not going to take no for an answer. And they go, okay, Mr. Benjamin, if you say so. So be prepared to fight. It can be worth it. So fight it out.
Yeah, just as a clarification, I wasn't actually aware that things had changed either, and we had the district director from the Division of Blind Services come to our last chapter meeting, and she indicated that this was now a part of the Florida requirements. So that's where my information came from. Animal Hospital, that's really exciting. I can't believe I said that. Of course, that's where I used to send kitties and dogs when they had problems. But of course I meant the Piano Hospital.
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you are listening to Tuesday Topics. If you have comments about the show or a suggestion of a topic you would like to have discussed, send a message to TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. That's TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Once again, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
At the Piano Hospital is an interesting title. I don't know why they quite called it a piano hospital. I guess a place where you could make pianos that weren't particularly well or feel good again. But where was that located? And who is this guy Emil Fries anyway?
Piano Hospital was started by Emil Fries. He went to the Washington State School for the Blind, learned piano tuning, put himself through law school with piano tuning, and just about when he was supposed to become a lawyer, the position for continuing the piano tuning classes at the Washington State School for the Blind was offered to him, and he did that for a number of years until they phased it out in 1948. And the students really wanted to, that were in class at the time, wanted to continue their education and make piano tuning their trade. And so he opened a little business and called it the Piano Hospital School, and continued from there. Actually, the name has changed now. I think now it's the Emil Fries School of Piano Tuning and Technology for the Blind. It's a lofty way so that all of your name covers all of the topics and areas of the industry, but that's just a little bit about Emil and where he came from. He was an old Dane and just a wonderful man. I'm proud to call him my mentor, and he has passed away now, and Piano Hospital is kind of a trade name of us old guys that went to school way back when.
It actually is kind of interesting that that Emil Fries was also interested in getting a piano tuner special interest affiliate started in ACB, and it did get started and ran for a year or two, but I think really did not manage to survive. So maybe that's one of the things you can do in your retirement, William, is get it started again, because I think it would be really good if we could actually make that happen still.
Well, one of the things about piano tuning is today it has a stigma about it that it's not computers. And one of the things I say is that today's niche business is tomorrow's stigma, because for a while they did. They routed everybody into piano tuning, and for a while they did. They routed everybody into Randolph Shepard, and nowadays they're routing everybody into computer technology. But life isn't over yet, and be it as it may, piano tuning's a just fine little trade. It has a uniqueness about it. It's a very sensitive art. It's like massage therapy. Gadzooks, it's just one of those things that does happen to lend itself to the blind. But it's just how you look at things and which things you choose to appreciate, I suppose.
I think the only other person who is supposed to be with us at the moment is Pam Drake. Do you have a question or a comment for William? Let's give you a shot at trying it, see if it works. Otherwise, William and I will go back to talking to each other.
My question, William, if you don't mind, I was fascinated to hear you mention in the beginning of your remarks your discussion of, and you touched on it a little bit at the beginning and then a little bit further on at the end or in the middle, about not counting yourself short. I'm just a this, I'm just a that. You seem to have been very motivated about taking the aptitudes that you had and working with them. I know of people who either have not made it in what they would consider a meaningful job, or in some situations where employers have found reason to dismiss the blind employee while not admitting that the reason they're doing it is because of blindness, and or other people who have just not been successful at getting any kind of job despite their best efforts at the tried and true professions. My question is, how did you always have this sense of self? And if you did, I'm certainly glad, but do you have any ideas? Do you have any pearls of wisdom as to how a person might develop or learn? I know of several people who said, I'd love to go into business for myself, but I don't know what I would be good at. I've only done one thing in my life, and that's all I know. And in rehab, is in other states, we're in California, is not very outgoing with let's see if you can do this type promotion. What can you tell us, or do we need to ask you to send or sell us a copy of Metamorphosis?
Well, and I almost touch on that very thing in Metamorphosis. If we could just bottle or can that special ingredient that made people successful, we would be millionaires, more so than Bill Gates, because there's no single answer. I certainly, absolutely, I think one of the number one things, and I'm kind of a rebel in this area, but if there's a number one thing I think that helped the blind or any disability be successful, is lose the blindisms. For God's sake, that's number one. You know, I suppose education is above that, but being able to make other people comfortable around you that you're just a regular Joe or an average guy or a normal person, whatever normal might be. And whenever we delve into this subject in the blindness community, there's just so many facets of it, and I'm sure the psychiatrists and psychologists with their MBAs and all that stuff can come out of the woodwork and talk me down in the corner. But in my heart, I think that has a lot to do with it, is not looking different and not acting different. And we all do. We see these people, the guy who advertises OxyClean, the way he's overzealous and talks, and he's a dork, what can I say, but he's made it. You know, there are those people who say, I'm going to be the way I am no matter what, and people can take me or leave me. Well, that's just fine, but I really believe that losing the blindisms and being socially acceptable has a big part to play in it.
I guess one of the questions that I would raise with you is, are there special things that a person needs to be successful at a business that they're running for themselves? I mean, there are a lot of people who go through services for blind folks and end up going to work for the state or end up going to teach at a piano hospital or end up going to teach in a school or end up going to work in a business. But are there special things that a person needs to have in order to be successful as an entrepreneur that would differentiate them from the folks who perhaps would do better working for somebody else? And if there are special things, what are some of those?
Well, I'm glad you reminded me to bring this up. You triggered my memory about something that I think is real important. And I'll delve into it by telling the story that brought it home to me. And it just happened in this last year. And I was at Florida State University for a little seminar on piano tuning or technician work and stuff like that. And I got to the tech room early, and I was visiting with a student who was just about to graduate in piano tuning and technology. And I said, you know, what are you going to do? And she says, well, I'm looking for a job now. And I asked her, you know, have you thought about going into business for yourself? And she said, no. She says, that's a whole different field. She said, running a business. I want to be a piano tuner, and I don't want to deal with all of that. I just want to develop my craft and be good at what I'm at. I don't want to be a business person. And it struck me so profoundly that running a business is a separate career from being a piano tuner. And if you're going to go out there and be in business for yourself, you have to learn how to run a business above and beyond whatever it is that you do well. And that really just seems so amazing that I had never thought of it before. But you do. You have to learn how to manage money and account for money and beat the bushes and develop leads and market yourself and all that stuff. It has nothing to do with piano tuning, or it has nothing to do with massage, or any one of the different careers we can go into. It really profoundly struck me that running a business is a career unto itself. And so if you're going to run your own business, you've got to learn two careers right from the get-go.
So how do you do that? Well, or perhaps I should really ask, how did you learn to do it? Because you very quickly got to the point where you'd received your original training, and then suddenly, hey presto, you were running three different stores. So how'd you do it?
Fair question. One of the things I did when I went back to school and planned my classes around my tuning, or planned my tuning around my classes, whichever you want to say, I took business classes. And there again, they were really vague because they were talking about all of the different multitudes of businesses there are. And so they really didn't zero in on my silly little career that nobody cared a hoot about. And one of the things that really amazed me is there was this one business class I took, and he said there's going to be two parts to the business class. The first part's going to be on a small independent business that's quality oriented, and the second part of the class is going to be on a large business that is production oriented with small markup, but with the amount of production you make big profits. And one of my good friends that I chummed around with at the time, his dad owned the Chevrolet dealership in town, and his dad says, well, if you want to take over my business, you got to go to school a little bit. So he went to school and worked at the Chevrolet dealership selling when he wasn't in school or studying. I don't remember exactly, but I'll say that when we talked about a small business, he talked about a jewelry store, and when we talked about a shoe store, and when we talked about a big business, he wrote his final paper on widgets or something, you know, who knows what. Well, when I took the class, right beside him, and it was time to do a small business. I did it on a small piano tuning business. And when we did the big class portion of the class, I did it on a big scale piano tuning business. I brought it home to me. And much was the same when I took advertising. And one of the things I suppose you could point at is I was aged then. I was up in my 30s. And a lot of the students were 18, 19, right fresh out of high school. And damn me for saying this, but they didn't have a brain in their head yet. So I'm kidding. But they did all of this, I suppose, you could say looking for their niche. But I always brought everything right back home to exactly what I was doing and what would be important to me. And one of the things I did is I got introduced to a bookkeeper and made an a point to become friends with him and get good prices on him doing my books for a few years. And what I had him do, I says, I want you to show me a set of books that I will never grow out of. And so he sat down and showed me what a spreadsheet was and the key things that were important. And so I learned to do spreadsheet and keep my own books, gadzooks, way back in 74. And I still keep my own books today, right now on Excel, so that when it comes time to do my taxes, I just take them into H&R Block and lay them out in front of him and say, these are the bottom numbers. Fill in the form and I'll sign it. And I run my own business completely.
So then I guess aside from, yes, I do agree with, you know, being, making yourself interesting and less frustrating and off-putting, whatever, making yourself a regular person to the sighted world and the general public. I do agree with that. I guess what I'm trying to get at, is it one of these things, either you have an idea or you don't, and if you don't, is it something you can invent, or is it something that, and as you say, I would like to get hold of your book. You are, Jack, like it was just as common to you as the air you breathe. I also believe that common sense is not that common, because the people who have it think it is because they do, and the rest of folks, me sometimes included, don't. And the current emphasis on direct marketing, used to be called multi-level marketing, is that a help or a hindrance? Do people get so caught up in the product that they don't, the product they're selling, that they don't learn business skills? Or does even selling a product in that kind of a marketing scheme teach you something about business?
You know, I hate to say it, but they go hand in hand. And that, I don't mean to do it as a cop-out, but they do. You bring out a good point, and I briefed over it very quickly, but the value of a vocational interest test can be very revealing. That's what got me into piano tuning. It really did. And I can also tell you I have a brother who liked cars and he liked mechanics, and he even got his private pilot's license before he went in the Air Force because he wanted to fly. And he went in the Air Force and he took all these battery of interest tests, and they said, you'll make a good electrician, sign here and we'll be assigning you in the morning. Well, they sent him off to computer school, and he excelled in it to the point where he retired from the Pentagon after 20 years. And there again, it was a vocational interest test. That's a good thing. In Metamorphosis, one of the things I say is, if you don't know what you want to do, get off by yourself and think about it. Set aside a reasonable length of time to go sit in a field of dandelions and think about it. Or talk to a good friend that you know and can trust, or a couple, three of them, and ask them and tell them that, you know, I've got to this point where I'd like to do something. I got this itch, but I don't know what to do. And figure it out and give it a reasonable length of time. You know, a lifetime career deserves a month to 3 months to make a decision. That's a reasonable length of time, but get the decision made and move on. One of the ways it can be done is to get a hold of your state rehab counselor, who can send you to the local college and take a vocational interest test, and then sit down with a counselor and go over the results and find out what it is that's coming out that you'd never even thought about.
I think it's really important for you to be sure that the person you talk about interest tests with is someone who has some understanding of the kinds of jobs that blind folks can do. Because to talk about a vocational interest test with folks who don't understand anything about blind people is going to significantly skew the results of or the way that other people are going to interpret those tests for you.
The counselor that said that to you wasn't worth his salt. That's all there is to it. That's why I think a vocational rehab person, you know, that's someone who's dedicated their lives to helping the blind. And if it suits you, find yourself a blind voc rehab counselor. And that's what George Fogarty was. He was blind. You need someone who knows what we're going through and what we're up against and our limitations. And anybody who did that to you, I'm glad you didn't listen to them, because they're not worth their salt.
You talked earlier about putting together a plan when you were studying business for a small piano tuning business and then for a large piano tuning business. I guess that's a little confusing to me, because piano tuning business by its very definition sounds to me as though it ought to be a small business. And yet here you had three stores. So how do you start a large piano tuning business?
Well, first of all, let's be absolutely candid that piano tuning and piano shop by its very nature is always small. It's never going to be the size of transportation like General Motors and Ford. It's never going to be as large as IBM or Microsoft. It's never going to be. Even Sherman Clay, the largest store in the world, you know, they only made $150 million a year, for crying out loud. That has no comparison at all to the big three automakers, or Toyota or Nissan. So by its very nature, it's going to be small. But still, staying in the context of that, I would look at a small business as doing in-home tunings, and every once in a while bringing home, we have what they call the action of the piano, which oftentimes it wears out and needs tightening and cleaning and lubricating, and so we take it out of the piano and bring it back to the shop and disassemble it and clean it and tighten it and lubricate it and take it back to the home and clean the piano and sometimes put on new key tops and sometimes new felts and tune the piano up, and there you go. That's a small piano tuning business, as opposed to a large piano business is when you have a couple 3,000 square foot of shop to work with and you restring and refinish and rebuild grand pianos. In order to make a shop like that work, you've got to be able to produce about a piano a month. I have had shops where I produced a piano a month. I haven't refinished a lot of pianos. I'd say four or six dozen, something like that, in my life. But that's more than one or two. And I didn't keep that part of it going, because sometimes sales got in the way and different things. But that's kind of the difference between it, whether it's a small repairs in the home and tuning, or if it's complete tear down of the piano, what they say, frame up, right from the bottom up, where you take out the iron plate, refinish the piano, and put it back in and turn every nut, bolt, and screw in the piano, restring it, new hammers, new dampers, new ivories, refinish it, and completely reproduce, a Steinway or Baldwin or Yamaha. That's a large shop.
Pam Drake again. Then I gather from what you're saying that piano tuning is still a viable employment for people who would be interested in pursuing it. I know a lot of us may tend to think that it's not the thing anymore, or that there isn't as much opportunity, and of course you have to deal with your transportation issues, etc. But it sounds as though you're saying that there's still a good future for enterprising people who would be interested in that profession.
Yes, you're right, Pam, and there's a few things there I'd just love to comment on. We have piano tuning conferences for the blind, as well as the alumni meeting for the blind from the Piano Hospital. And one of the biggest nuts to crack is getting from point A to point B. It is tough. There's no way around it. Drivers come and drivers go. You have to be a people person to handle employees because nobody's perfect. And that's what you got to do is work with their faults. Every single driver I've had, there's something about them that I think I would have liked to have seen change. But you can't change people. They are the way they are, and that's all there is. And you learn to get along with it or move on, one or the other. Here's a good example. My transportation bill runs between $250 and $500 a month. That's piano tuning. If I had a car, I bought new cars when I have been with sighted ladies, and I know a $20,000 new car with $3,000 down is $400 a month. I know that it runs $100 a month or better for insurance. I know it runs a couple hundred dollars a month for gas, especially with prices today. I can take a lot of cabs and hire a lot of drivers for $600 or $700 a month. The trade-off is I only have the driver for short lengths of time, and I have to plan things strategically. The person who's paying that $600-$700 a month for a car, and if you go for a $30,000 car, everything goes up from there, they have far more freedom, and it's wonderful. I wish them the best, but my expenses, in the short view, you'd think, oh, you've got to pay that dollar, $9 an hour for a driver. It really does work out in the end. And so answer another quick question of yours as far as piano tuning dying. I suppose it's possible. I don't foresee the violin ever going away. I don't foresee the saxophone ever going away. I don't foresee the drums ever going away. And all of these things are reproduced on a synthesizer. So I don't foresee the piano going away. I see it is on the decline. As a matter of fact, I can tell you last year there was 115,000 units sold in America. As a matter of fact, about 40% of them were grands. So I know my statistics. I know what's going on, and it is declining a bit. But here's another way to look at it. Number one, there's a few thousand piano tuners in America, 10,000-12,000 piano tuners. So there's a little bit of room for a person to still get in the field. But think of it this way. The more exclusive this field gets, the happier that makes me. And if you want a good illustration, I'm great for illustrations, is try to get a covered wagon repaired. If you go out looking for a covered wagon repairman, you're going to pay real big bucks. And the more exclusive pianos get, the more the price is going to go up, and the more I like it.
William, we've come to the end of our program. It's kind of frightening. I think all of us have actually learned a good deal about what's required of an entrepreneur, and we've also managed to learn an awful lot about a person who's lived a pretty full life and has been able to accomplish an awful lot. I'd like to express my appreciation to you for the time that you've spent talking with us. And let me once more give folks your email address. That's blindwilly, B-L-I-N-D-W-I-L-L-Y, at comcast.net. And our address is tuesdaytopics@acbradio.org. I'd like to thank everyone for listening. And remember, everyone, a well-tuned piano is sort of like a well-tuned blind person. They sound much better than either when it's out of tune. Good night, everyone.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 1 hour Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. We'll look for you in the Our Place Politics Chat Room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.